They say we all, being average, spend $2,700 per year eating out. There being 316 million of us averages in this country, that means we eat up over $853 billion a year eating out. And so we ask, how do we open up a restaurant? Hello, you are tuned in to the 995th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Sitovecchia who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with a whole studio full of engineers helping us out there today. Richard and MZ, thank you very much for being there for us. Well, folks, let's run some numbers. We each spend an average of $2,700 per year eating out. There are 316 million of us averages eating out every year. Okay, 2,700 times 316 million. Wow. Holy smokes. That's $853 billion a year we spend eating out. Now, $853 billion is a lot of money to be sitting there on the table waiting to be gobbled up. All that money sitting on the table leads us to ask, how do we start a restaurant? And here to help us today, cook up an answer, we have Tom Bruce, who's a consultant with Central Coast Food and Beverage. Tom, welcome to the Food Chain. So happy to have you aboard.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here.
So with a voice like that, you should be in radio instead of restaurants. So how does one become a restaurant consultant? I would suspect that you had a lot of other jobs before you got to be a restaurant consultant.
I kind of followed the traditional path. I went to culinary school, did an apprenticeship, and eventually graduated into the industry and then into corporate positions. And eventually I just became too difficult to work with, so I had to become a consultant instead of an employee.
And there you are. So here you are, a consultant, and instead of being in the fire as it is in the kitchen. Well, who pays the way when you're a restaurant consultant? I always ask that of all my guests, and they always look at me and say, well, who does pay the way?
Well, most of our client base is, and it's national, and we've actually done some international work as well. Most of our client base is people who are expanding. We often work with franchisors who are getting ready to package their concept. And we do a lot of that kind of operational infrastructure, you know, training systems, menu development, purchasing programs. So the bulk of our clientele now is multi-unit or large single-unit operators. Mm-hmm. In the past, initially, it was, you know, one-offs. A couple of our early clients were Shadowbrook and Crow's Nest. Mm-hmm.
You know, I noticed from your list that there are not any franchises. I didn't see any franchises. Are there?
Well, there were people. City Walk is a franchise group. Mm-hmm. The Hampshire House, which is the Cheers concept in Boston, packaged themselves to franchise, and about then the recession hit, so they backed away from that. Mm-hmm. And some of our more recent clients aren't on there. We did a project in Southern California recently, and we haven't gotten our website quite updated there.
Nobody has an updated website. That's the thing about websites. They're all there. Well, I was just wondering, you know, when you do it, it would seem like if you're a franchisee, you would get franchise advice from the franchisor, correct? I mean, it would be kind of like a package you're buying.
Yeah, that's what they tell you. Most of the franchise groups charge a percentage, and that's somewhere between 4% and 5%, and that's to assist with marketing, operational stuff, updating concepts. We do a lot of national purchasing programs. So those are the services that they provide. They often also will work on real estate and site locations and so on and so forth. But our role with them is more of a one-time deal. We just kind of set them up, and then often we'll come in and revamp or maintain that for them.
Mm-hmm. So everybody needs a little help along the way. What is the survival rates of restaurants?
Well, you know, there's a lot of misinformation that they're the highest failure rate of any business. And I actually just read an article, and I don't remember who produced it, but it was reputable. And it said that they have about the same fail rate as any other small business, which I think is still relatively high. It's probably 30%.
Well, that's, you know, 3 in 10.
Yeah.
So that means 70% survive.
Well, you know, I'm just making that assumption, but I think that's probably pretty accurate, yeah.
Well, okay, now the biggest question of all, which is the most important, ambience, food, price, or service?
Well, that's really a factor of demographics. You know, if you're in what we call a penetration market, or then it's a high value.
What is penetration market?
Well, penetration is where you're going into a marketplace and you're trying to get in as many people as possible. And that often requires, you know, or would mandate less ambiance and higher value, lower price points. Skimming concepts, and Morton's would be an example of that, are located in areas where there's a pretty high percentage of affluent individuals, and they work only in the top 5 or 10% of those demographics.
Wow. So there it is. Good. Well, we're going to head for a break here in a few minutes, but before we do, I want to kind of set this up. But like, there's a lot of money out there. We all eat out. We all love to cook, or at least some of us love to cook. The rest of us love to eat. So we all have a stake in this, and wondering what we can possibly do to start a restaurant. And so that's, I guess, what I'd like to take this conversation in. And what is the first question you think we should ask before we start a restaurant?
Well, the biggest problem with small operators or people who are just starting out is they don't, I guess the question you'd have to ask is, do I have the business expertise? Because there's a whole lot more to it even than running other businesses. And people seem to think this is just, it's going to be a never-ending social event and it'll be lots of fun. And it's really just lots of work.
But if they have fun.
If they have fun, yeah. Uh-huh. If they have fun, yeah.
So the most important thing is, how much do you want to give up of yourself to operate this restaurant?
Really? Absolutely. And whether or not you can approach it as an entrepreneurial business, or if you're really just looking for a job. And often people are doing just that. They really just want to buy a job, and something that they enjoy doing. And you know, that's certainly rewarding as well. Yeah.
Well, is that a good way of approaching it, though? I mean, you want to buy a job? Would it be better just to go get a job?
Well, that's kind of my point to many of them, is that you're investing a lot of money to buy a job that you wouldn't take if somebody gave it to you. So
you want a job washing dishes? Here you go.
12 hours a day for something less than minimum wage, yeah.
Well, you know, I know a number of restaurateurs, and it takes a lot to establish that restaurant.
It does.
And
it does.
You know, the restaurateurs, the successful ones I see who have done so really with their own time. They really put the time in on the job.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think any small business is demanding in that same way.
Well, of course. So the first question, and the most important one then, is just how much of yourself are you going to give up
Absolutely.
To do this work? Because this work is going to take it out of you. You're going to be there. When the cook doesn't show up, you have to be there to do the cooking, right? Yeah, that's the way
it's
it works.
Just like when the engineer doesn't show up.
Well, that never happens around here. Well, good enough. I guess we're tuned in for a break in about a minute. Richard, we're going to take a break here in 1 minute, you think? We don't know yet. It'll be a surprise if it happens around here. Well, so then, that being the case, let's go to the next one. What about permits and licenses? What is it going to take for us? What kind of licenses do we need?
Well, the standard business license, health permit, it's again, if you're building a place, you go through a process called plan check. Most people who who go into the industry are going to take over something. So that's really just a matter of a business license. You may have an issue with a liquor license and getting the appropriate health department approvals. And one of the real key pieces of advice that we give all new operators is that if you're taking over a facility, renting or leasing something, is to have the government agencies that are going to inspect you after you open come inspect the facility before you open, and identify code violations for you, because that's really the landlord's the landlord's responsibility. So once you're in there and you're in business, you know,
it's too late.
Then it becomes your responsibility. Yeah.
So work with the landlord. That, of course, takes us to the landlord. Oh, my goodness. I think we're going to pause for a really quick break. And when we come back, we'll go from here. Maybe not. Okay, then we're just going to keep rolling. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Today we're talking about starting a restaurant. I know you've had the fantasy because you like to cook. Or maybe you like to eat. We know you like to eat one or the other. So you've had this fantasy about, I'm starting my own restaurant. Wow, there's $853 billion out there in the United States on the table waiting for people to start restaurants. So that's what we're talking about today. What does it take? First question, of course, was how much are you willing to put into it? And that's something that I guess all small business people have to come to grips with when it gets right down to it. Because when you work for yourself, you have to do, you know, you're responsible for everything. And there it is. Next big question, I guess, is the licenses. And I know food safety is a huge issue these days in restaurants and in all food services, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So is that part of the permitting process, and is that something you have to bear down on as well?
Yeah, in California, there's a couple of requirements. There's management certification. And depending
on... So if you're a manager, you have to become certified?
The state law requires that one person in every operation has that certification. They have to be a full-time employee. So we try and encourage the owner-operators to have that, because obviously if an employee has it and they leave, the certification leaves with them. So that's a little bit more complicated process. And then all food handlers in California now have to have a food handler's card, which is a very simplified version of food safety, but at least it's better than nothing.
What does that mean, a card?
Well, it's a basic training. It's
okay,
mostly
so you have to wash your hands.
When you wash your hands and cook temperatures and so on and so forth. And California was honestly behind the times with that, with both certification processes. 2000 was the year that we started management certification, and more recently, I think it was about 3 years ago that we started the actual food handlers.
Okay, so we're getting serious about it then.
Well, more serious than we used to be anyway.
Good to go. You know, the big question, of course, is that we're going to start a restaurant. How do we finance it? Where do we get the money to do this?
Well, you know, most of the small operators, and we primarily work with small operators through the various small business development centers, the SBDC centers. Most of them are self-funded, or they may have a family investor or a silent partner. Once you become established, then it's a little bit more traditional financing.
Once you can show the money, show somebody the money and have something, some collateral to back it up.
Yep. So often, if there is financing involved, it's SBA financing initially.
So if you have some money down, maybe you can get some money. But you have to have some money.
You have to have some money to start off with. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
What about location?
Well, location, again, really depends on the type of concept that you're doing. And this is one of the big issues that we see often with operators is they'll come up with develop a pretty good concept and get so excited about it that they put it in a bad location. So it really takes a combination of the two.
They're in a hurry, right?
They're in a hurry. Yep. I've got it all figured out. I've got the money. I'm going to do it. And they'll look for a place that they can afford rather than a place that is appropriate for that type of concept.
Well, different restaurants, I would believe, require different concepts.
Absolutely.
So what if we were starting a quick serve restaurant?
Well, fast casual or quick service fast food all requires lots of foot traffic or street traffic.
I'll look for good traffic then.
Yeah, lots of traffic, high profile, high visibility.
Mm-hmm.
As we get more and more specialized, we can move more into what's called a destination location, which is a place that people will come to have the experience.
Well, that's a different kind of food.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's generally higher end, and it's more what we call experience driven. In marketing, we develop what we call UEPs and USPs. And USPs are product-driven.
USP?
It's a unique selling point.
Okay.
And that's a product-driven experience for the guest. And then UEPs are experience providers, unique experience providers. That might be a type of service. It might be a location. Shadowbrook or Crow's Nest, again, are great examples.
Fancy places, destination resort restaurants.
Yeah.
I have a friend who has a Chinese restaurant that is in a strip mall at the edge of town, and it's a really nondescript-looking building. And yet people go there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they seek it out. It has a reputation, but that's not something you can just get. You have to really earn that over a period of time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I know who you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And when they first started out, they were one of the few players in town that really had good Asian food.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've kept that edge. So, yeah, I know people that drive from here to there, which is not an easy feat in the summertime, right?
Yeah. Well, what about the different? It seems like there's, you know, we've really had a blossoming of ethnic kinds of food restaurants.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
What are the differences? I mean, there's obviously, when you're in California, you're going to have like a zillion, Latin American restaurants. And we do.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the notable differences in running those types of those ethnic restaurants?
Well, I don't know that there's notable differences based on the type of concept like that. What we do see is that new directions and concepts, the Pacific Rim and the farm to table and things that are relatively new, at least in the last 10 years or so, start at the coast and they work their way inland. So, New York City, San Francisco, L.A., and then kind of eventually hit the heartland. And they're great influences, but I look at them more as influences. I they kind of come and go, and parts of them stay when mm-hmm. they go. So concepts... It's called concept evolution. Concepts, continuously change, which is really what makes them interesting.
They're kind of like a Chuck E. Cheese pizza.
I don't know that Chuck E. Cheese has changed too much.
Well, it's one of those concepts.
It's one of those concepts. And when you're playing to nine-year-olds, you don't need to change it.
You don't need to change it. Yeah, you've got the nine-year-old and you got parents to drag the parents in, and so you've got it made there.
Yeah.
What are some of the other concepts that have stuck over time?
Well, I was thinking about that this morning because I knew it would be a question. And it's again real interesting. If you look back 30 years ago, the longevity of steak and lobster, prime rib, those types of concepts, It was really amazing compared to today's market where things are changing much more rapidly. But I think the concepts that have legs or that last a long time, even though they need to be modified in the whole evolutionary process, are concepts that give you a relatively high value and variety, but really deal with quality ingredients. And I think that's one of the big issues. You know, whether you're a fast casual or a fine dining or someplace in between, it's really the product quality that...
food.
The ingredients going in and the creativity with producing the menu items.
Wow. So, what about the ambience? Is that not part of the
product? Absolutely. Sure.
And the service?
Sure. And it all has to tie together. It has to tie in, and that, again, is what we call brand image. So mm-hmm. who we are and what we do, and there has to be it has to mesh. There has to be continuity and all that.
You know, I often wonder about the role of food and service in a restaurant. And I have a friend who is a restaurateur who started as a chef. Mm-hmm. And so his idea was that the chef should get the tips. And the service should give the tips to the chef. And so that's the rule he instituted in his restaurant. And now he has a reputation for having wonderful food, but not so good service. So how do you orchestrate a staff? You have the people in the back who are cooking the food, and you have the people in front who are serving the food, and then you have a restaurant manager. How do you orchestrate that dance so that the food and the service work together?
It's a great question, Michael, and we often experience one that doesn't fit with the other mm-hmm. one. And I think we've all been down that path. Great food, bad service, bad food, great service. And it's really it begins at the very beginning of the business. It's building a culture that works together, that intermeshes well. People are always financially driven. So things like tip pooling, where the tips are pooled and then distributed among all of the staff, are great ways to approach that from a financial standpoint. But it really comes from training, from creating a culture, and from keeping the people engaged in that culture.
And that's a matter of management then, right?
It's a matter of management after the fact, but it's really the ownership who create the culture in the beginning.
So the owner to the... You know, a long time ago there was a restaurant here in our hometown of Santa Cruz, California, called the New Riverside Restaurant. I don't know if you ever had the opportunity to visit that. It was alleged to be one of the 7 best Sichuan Chinese restaurants in the world. And people came from all over the world to eat at this restaurant. And it had a wonderful manager who was able to orchestrate this wonderful dance between the chefs, who were all Chinese-speaking Chinese, and the wait staff, who were, Anglo.
Uh-huh.
And he did this most beautiful job of pulling this together. So whenever you went to this restaurant, it was a wonderful experience, a very magical experience. Then he got caught with his fingers in the cookie jar and ended up in the hoosegow. And no matter what the restaurant tried to do, it couldn't figure out how to bring those two elements together, the element of the wonderful chefs in the kitchen, and the Chinese chefs, and the wait people, and it just never gelled, and the restaurant went out of business.
Well, and I guess that kind of goes full circle back to my point. What happened there was the manager created the culture instead of the owner. And when the manager,
which was a corporation based in Tokyo, so there you go.
But when the manager left, the culture left with it.
Yeah.
And, that's where we kind of come in with our clients, is that we often will come in after they've hired 2 or 3 individuals to work within the company and bring you know, structured. Maybe they came from a more structured environment. The problem is that they didn't create that structure. They just functioned within it. And so they may implement some changes, but then as soon as they leave, the changes go with them. So it's the difference between management and culture.
And who can pull it together at the same time, right?
Absolutely. But it starts in the, you know, it starts before you open.
CBS News
afterwards.
Update, I'm Pam Coulter.
Oh, there's... I just turned it off so we don't have to do it. I think we have telephones now, right? So people can call in. If you have an interest in starting a restaurant, here's a perfect opportunity for you to pick up your phone and talk to a person who knows how to open restaurants. His name's Tom Bruce, and he has his own Central Coast food and beverage consultancy here on the Central Coast of California. Pick up your phone and ask any question you want. The area code is 831-479-1080, 479-1080. And Tom can answer any calls that you want, answer any question about restaurants that you want. And what a fun thing, because there's $853 billion waiting for us to gobble it up. All we have to do is open up the right kind of restaurant, and away we go. And that's not as easy as it would seem, though, is it? I mean, a lot of people think of it. What's the biggest obstacle, you think, to really pulling this off?
Well, again, having a complete understanding of what they're getting into. You know, people who have worked in the industry, especially if they've been in key roles, management functions or something along those lines, tend to be more successful than, you know, your neighbor who just inherited some money and decides he wants to open a barbecue joint, because they have a little bit of time under their belt.
Maybe not a bad thing to do then, get a job in a restaurant. If we've never worked in a restaurant, maybe you better jump in and wait some tables or something and get an idea for what it takes to wait on tables. Often thought that it should almost be mandatory for all young people to get a job waiting tables, because it's such a wonderful place to learn how to interact with people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Not only are you... you know, serving them food, but you're also, the good waiters are in sales too.
Well, that, and you're learning about teamwork and timing and supporting other people, and, you know, so there's a lot to it. There's a lot to it.
And you have to make it all work. I was wondering about leases. You know, when we go into business, should we get a short-term lease or a long-term lease?
Well, our best option there is to get a lease tenure that we can live with if we go out of business, but to get enough options and to qualify how those options are, what they're going to cost, so that if the business is successful and we decide we want to sell it, there's enough time left on the lease to make it marketable. If we go in with a 5-year lease and we put 2 years or 3 years into building the business, it's very difficult because there's no extension on that lease to sell it with only a couple years left. So
you don't have anything to sell.
You really don't. So, and people will often be overly cautious and not look at the whole option scenario. So you really want to get in. We suggest a minimum of a 3-year lease, maybe, if you're, you know, concerned about it, but then 2 or 3 5-year options.
So if you don't give yourself some time, everything that you do to build that position in the mind of the marketplace, your restaurant, is not worth anything because you have to leave.
Absolutely.
Or somebody else will come in and rent it under. Well, we have a phone, so we're going to pick up. Let's see, who do we have? We have Fox calling. Fox, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program. You're talking with Tom Bruce.
Good morning, and thank you for being there. Love your show.
Thank you.
I have a question for Tom. I did not inherit the cooking gene. My mom's Italian, great cook. My daughter, great cooks. I'm great at growing food, but the kids call me the cremation cook, so we're just going to skip that. I wanted to know about doing a private commercial kitchen where we can do jams and cookies, and we can send them out to markets in that way? Does Tom set up those type of enterprises?
Oh, good question.
Actually, we're doing a fair amount of work through the SBDC and the Pajaro CDC. So we're, you know, Cottage Food Bill is what you're talking about, and that's becoming licensed to work out of your home. And there's some qualifiers on that. It's relatively easily done. And environmental health will kind of help you with that through that process. You are limited in the amount of money that you can generate. I think year one it's $35,000, and then it's $50,000 the second year. But don't
hold
me to that.
Is that profit or
no sales?
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
So it's almost like they force it not to. How can you do that? $35,000 that. In gross sales?
Yeah. Then you have to go to what's called a commercial kitchen, and your best bet with that is to go someplace like the El Pajaro Kitchen, which is, it's a 9,000 square foot facility, really state of the art. I was involved in both the design and equipment and whatnot. And you can rent various stations there by the hour. So it's pretty reasonable. And it's licensed. And then if you get into the whole manufacturing thing, and that's triggered by you not selling the product. If you get to the point where you, say you're selling it to a local market and then they sell it, then you have to have a state manufacturing license. So it really depends. There's two or three qualifiers in there. It's not difficult to get started, but you do, there are points where you kind of go through a hurdle.
And lots of hurdles.
And lots of hurdles. Yeah.
Any further questions, Fox?
That gives me a good start. Thank you so much.
Sure. I think the same thing that happened to you with respect to the cooking gene skipping a generation happened to me as well.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. 831-479-1080. We appreciate your calls. We have Tom Bruce, restaurant consultant. Everything you wanted to know about starting your own restaurant food service business. A lot of new kinds of restaurants, because restaurants on wheels now.
Absolutely. And those are some of my favorites. I actually spent some time with one of my longtime clients who's just opened or set up a food truck that runs out of his restaurant. He's doing great. He's making a living off the food truck alone. And it's kind of high-end stuff, which surprised me. I mean, he's got $18 items coming off of his off of his food truck.
So how does that dynamic work? You have to have a place to go with your food truck. And then when you go someplace and somebody sees you there, they're going to want to go there too, right?
It depends on how you do it. And there's a lot of underground stuff, especially on the East Coast. But on the up and up, you not only have to build the truck out, which in his case was about $100,000, but it's really a nice truck. You also have to either get a route, and I'm not sure how you do that, but it's an established route. You pay for it. But he does primarily special events, so he'll go and basically cater an office party. The other day when I was there, they had three events in the truck, one after the other. So
wow.
He's doing quite well with it, and there's some really interesting food, and it's
So it takes some clever marketing there, doesn't it?
It does, but it's a lot less expensive than opening a restaurant, so.
The expenses being just the ingredients of the food and
building out the truck and
having a nice looking truck.
Yeah.
And away you go.
And some of them aren't so nice looking. So.
Yeah, I'm always kind of leery of those for some reason. Yeah. You know, you look at the truck and you go, not so certain about
maybe
that.
Maybe not that one.
No. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of eating on the street in Tijuana sometimes. Uh-huh. And you go, not so certain about that. What about equipment? You know, when we look at starting a restaurant and we don't have much money, should we buy the new stuff? Should we lease it? Should we rent it? What's the most efficient way to get into the equipment itself?
Well, there's, you know, there's all kinds of different approaches there. That's one of the advantages of taking over an existing facility is that much of the heavy equipment, the more expensive stuff's existing, may not be in great shape, but at least you don't have to buy it right out of the gate. There are certain things that make sense to buy used, other things not so much. Refrigeration, we tend to stay away from used equipment there. Things like ranges and grills, if they're in good shape, you can get great deals. And you can also lease equipment, dish machines. When we did the incubator kitchen in Watsonville, we leased all the refrigeration, a couple other pieces of equipment, and it was a zero-interest two-year buy-down. So it was basically 0% financing for 2 years.
Wow. Free money.
Free money, yeah. Yeah, but it takes a good equipment guy. We work with a guy up in Scotts Valley who really knows what's going on mm-hmm. there.
Now, some equipment probably, you know, not so good to buy or to I'm thinking like of in farming, there's the hay baler,
uh-huh.
you know, that always breaks down.
Sure.
So
sure.
is there equipment inside the restaurant that always breaks down, maybe the ice makers or something like that?
Well, yeah, ice makers are probably the most complex piece of equipment you have in your restaurant. But
I mean, you have these gas grills. There's nothing going to go wrong with them.
Not much going to happen there. No. The point of sale system and the dish machine are two things we always encourage people to lease. Point of sale systems are relatively expensive, which is difficult, but
point of sale being like the cash register
and the
order machine where they punch a colorful button and the order pops up in the kitchen.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that technology, like all other technology, is moving so quickly that, you know, you spend $25,000 on an Aloha system and 2 years later it's outdated. So most of those companies now will lease you the product, and they'll come and replace it every couple of years with better technology. Dish machines, same thing. They're expensive to buy. They're a bit trouble-prone. They require a lot of maintenance. So we encourage our people to lease those and then either pay a monthly fee or pay for the chemicals. There's different packages out there.
Well, the big question, booze, to booze or not to booze?
Well, I like to booze. there's, you know,
pros. You almost have to, don't you?
Nah, not really. I mean, beer and wine, I think, are pretty much a standard, but mm-hmm. a beer and wine license is much easier and less expensive to get. A full-service liquor license is not only expensive, but difficult. Difficult to obtain. You have to go through a background check. There's often a limited supply. They're expensive. So it's much more of a process.
Do you get in trouble?
You can get in trouble. Yeah, absolutely.
And what about the difference between a restaurant and a bar cafe?
You mean a bar with food and a restaurant with alcohol?
Yeah.
That's kind of the way we look at them.
I mean, I was thinking of Cheers.
Cheers
is kind of like a bar with food, right?
Yeah, Cheers is probably, we call that the split, how the sales are categorized. And Cheers is about 60% alcohol, 40% food. There's obviously less labor, less perishability and more profit in alcohol, but it's difficult to often to open just a bar. You know, there's almost always a requirement for food, and there's different
licenses. And the reason, of course, being if you eat some food with your booze, you can drink more booze.
Yeah, yeah. And when you talk about liquor licenses, the straight liquor licenses, I don't know what the number is on them, but they're even more difficult to get. They're more restricted. So often you're in a situation where they call it a 50-50 license, where you can only generate half your sales with alcohol.
Oh.
And I don't really know how closely they monitor that, but they do monitor it.
Well, they always say that that's where you make your money is, you know, you break even on the food and make your money on the alcohol.
Well, we'd like to make money on both sides. But, uh-huh. You know, it's you have to have profit in both sides, because generally, you know, the split is probably no more than 30% alcohol, and there's just not enough alcohol in most restaurants to make that carry the place.
Wow. What is the most lucrative food to serve? Yeah, I've heard, of course, and I have a cousin that has an Italian restaurant out in Wyoming, and she's it's a very good chef, and she talks about making her money on the spaghetti, well, and breaking even on the steaks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a great question and a great point, and there's two approaches to looking at that. Yeah, things like pastas are a great example. Pizza's another great example. Coffee drinks are also a good example. A very, what we call a low food cost. The cost of goods is low in relationship to the selling price. But the selling price is lower as well. Mm-hmm. So those are items that we have on the menu to take advantage of percentage pricing. Now, when we get into higher cost items like a steak, it's contribution margin, meaning the difference between dollars we sell it for and dollars we invest in it. So if we have a steak that costs us $20 and we can sell it for $40, we have $20 in gross profit. If we have a pasta that we sell for $15 that costs us $4, we only have $11 in gross profit. And it's really profit dollars that we're looking at.
Okay. That takes us to building a menu.
Uh-huh.
Whoa, what a science that must be.
There's a whole lot more to it than most people realize. Yeah.
So where do you begin? It's with those margins, right?
Well, there has to be a combination of those two in most concepts. There has to be both percentage driven and contribution driven items on the menu. And there's marketing function, which again, you know, the menu has to reflect the brand image. It has to be engineered properly to take advantage of eye travel patterns. And we're even doing a process now called heat mapping, where you can, you put on glasses and you look at the menu and it registers on the menu where you spend the most time.
Well, so you get people to actually wear these glasses when they go into a restaurant?
Yeah, this is done at, I think it's University of Washington. One of my colleagues is real big on it. And we did a heat map for the Huddle House restaurants. And it's pretty interesting. It's, again, new technology, stuff that wasn't around.
Wow, that's pretty intense, though. If you can actually map where somebody looks on a menu.
And how different graphics packages change that. Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty sexy stuff. Wow.
The thing that escapes most people and where they get caught is that you have to be very mobile in your menu, because introducing a new menu, regardless of how much effort you put into it, is really a crapshoot. And, if we're 80% successful on a new concept, we think we've done a great job. So we're always prepared with backup menu items to go different directions if necessary.
Different directions being, here's a different option. So, press the button and cough. Try it. Night and cough. But only...
You have to use that one right there.
Okay, we're getting
this button.
Yeah, we're getting all the engineering squared away here today. It'll probably take about 4 days to do it, but we'll do it. So, the staffing, you really have to, you talked a lot about the ownership and the responsibility of the ownership. It's the owner who really establishes the culture. Absolutely. And then it's the manager who maintains that culture. And so there's no way out. You know, you can't just be an owner and walk away, can you?
And no. That whole concept of going from working in your business to working on your business often escapes new operators. Mm-hmm. But the key with the recruiting and initial hiring and successes there are really they're training driven. You know, if you bring people into an environment, this is where your culture starts, where there are expectations, there's a good training program, good training materials. We generally now will build intranet-based training for both the front and back of the house, you know, the kitchen and the servers. And they're required to do that before they come in for hands-on training, and they have to establish a level of competency through testing. So if you have made a poor hire, and that happens sometimes for everybody and more mm-hmm. often for other people, you weed them out before you actually get them on the floor. If it takes them 5 days to pass a menu of competency tests, then they were the wrong people.
Then, so do the hard work up front.
Absolutely.
What happens when you get a bad employee and they get ingrained into the culture?
Well, it's called the ABCs of team building. You take the C players, which are the ones that we have to either make Bs or get rid of, and try to understand why they're C players. Mm-hmm. And help them become B players. And eventually, if they're non-responsive, then they have to go.
Wow. Simple as that.
Simple as that.
Tell me about some of your great success stories that you've seen in restaurants through the years. And you've seen a lot.
Well, I think probably the most successful company that I worked for was Scott Seafood. And this was back around 1980 when I went to work for them. I was with them.
Where are they at?
They were in San Francisco. They had seven or eight restaurants mm-hmm. at the end.
At the end?
Yeah, they disbanded, sold off, okay. did whatever. But when we opened the Embarcadero Scott's and you know, 1980, $1 million was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we did $4 million year one.
Wow.
And we did our first New Year's Eve, which happened to fall on a Friday. We did 1,600 people, 800 at lunch and 800 at dinner. And it functioned perfectly, and a big part of that was culture and
mm-hmm. Well, wait a minute. Training. You're seafood on the Embarcadero in San Francisco.
Uh-huh. But there's a lot of seafood on the Embarcadero.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Okay. So how did this place get to be, you know, so popular so quickly?
Well, it was their second unit. They had a unit down on Lombard Street, which was much smaller, but it was very busy as well.
Okay, yeah. So it had established a position in the mind of the market.
Right.
And here's
right.
a brand new Scott Seafood right on the Embarcadero, so you get to see, have an ocean view and everything.
Well, actually, we had a view of the Hyatt Regency. They had the ocean view. But it was, you know, that was a very affluent area.
Yeah.
It was good placement. And they just did things right. They used the best ingredients they could find. We put a lot of effort into training. And going back to culture, it was a year. It was almost 12 months before we lost our first kitchen employee, before somebody left.
Oh, so that's pretty good indication, really, of how things are going, isn't it? Turnover
ratio in the restaurant industry is about 125%
a year.
Yeah, so
that means you lose everybody plus
one and a quarter times.
Yeah. So
1.25 hires.
Wow, does that include chefs and everything?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and part of that is understandable, especially in the front of the house. A lot of people work their way through college.
Right, right. So you're working with young people who are
part-time jobs, mm-hmm. yeah. And a lot of it is just people get into it and realize they wish they hadn't, and so they go off and do something else. But poor operators are a big contributor to that, too.
Well, you know, one of my favorite subjects when looking at businesses are those businesses that flop. Because you can almost learn as many lessons from things that don't work as from the things that do work. So I'm sure you've seen a lot of flops.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us about some of the most magnificent ones?
Well, I try not to relate those stories.
Well, you don't have to tell the names or anything, but
yeah. Well, we were involved with a group on the East Coast.
And there, that's safe.
Yeah. We'll not get into too much detail. And they had a very small facility. They actually bought it because it was near one of their other restaurants, and they didn't want the competition. And they turned it into a fine dining restaurant, and it did okay, but it never made any money. It won several awards and turned over the staff fairly frequently. And we worked on it with them for 2 or 3 years, trying to make it a little bit more stable. Eventually, because we did manage to fix it, eventually we closed it. And reopened it as a neighborhood restaurant. And we put another $1 million on sales. And it became, rather than a place that the locals went to once a month, it became a place they stopped at twice a week. And that's really what turned the corner for them.
Often wondered about that. The hardest job in marketing, by far, is to reestablish a position, a favorable position, for something that has a bad position. And, you know, when a restaurant has a bad position, you know, people look at, oh, man, I got my neighbor ate there and got food poisoning or something like that. It's the end of the line.
Sure.
So is it better to close it down and, like you said, build something else in there, that paint it and change the colors? And
absolutely, yeah. And, you know, this particular place was just not profitable. I wouldn't say it was failing or that it had a bad name, but it still, because it was such a dramatic departure from the original concept, it needed to be redone. So we did some cosmetics inside, and it kept the same name.
Kept
the same name, and became the new neighborhood spot. To it was right near the Boston Common, so it very
still had a good
area.
Location. Had a great location.
It's in an alley, but yeah.
Well, sometimes isn't that the fun part of it, though? You know, finding places like that are off the beaten path.
Sure.
You know, the tourists don't know about, and it's becomes a good local place. And you go there and have some fun and meet your friends and neighbors. So what is the single best piece of advice you could give for somebody thinking about setting up their own restaurant?
Don't do it?
Yeah, other than don't do it.
I would say pay your dues. Spend 3 to 5 years in the industry. And work in as many different capacities as you can before you mortgage the house and tell the kids they can't go to college. Make sure it's the right thing for you. And if you need key individuals to help you, bring them in as partners and not as employees.
Ah, what's the difference?
Well, a partner has a vested interest, and your goals are common. So often employees, a key employee, a manager or a chef may not have the same outlook on things that you do.
Yeah, no skin in the game. So
no skin in the game.
There you go. Well, folks, this has been a lot of fun for me talking with Tom Bruce, who is a restaurant consultant with Central Coast Food and Beverage. How long have you been in the restaurant trade?
Oh, do we really have to go there, Michael? I started at a very young age as a dishwasher in a 24-hour coffee shop, and never quite left.
So. Yeah, I had a job as a dishwasher, but I left.
Yeah, humbling experience.
There you go. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this chaotic hour with restaurant consultant Tom Bruce. Thank you all for tuning in.